My name is Paul Bosch, and this session is The Passion of St. Sebastian, Why Pastors Hate Their Parishioners and Why Parishioners Hate Their Pastors. That was the original title that I was going to go with. I thought that sounded terribly offensive, so I changed it to When Pastors Hate Their Parishioners and When Parishioners Hate Their Pastors, in an attempt to make it a little softer. But I have some major misgivings about presenting this thing at all today, and I want to begin with that. Here's the outline. I put it on the board, the outline that I hope to follow. First of all, I have a major misgiving because I'm afraid I will offend you, and I don't really want to offend you. On the other hand, these things are not usually talked about. Even at a place like Holden Village, I have not heard them talked about. And so I think it's useful to talk about them in a relatively low-threat situation. I'm not your pastor, you know, and you can go home and say that crazy guy at Holden Village, you know, was out to lunch. But this is a relatively low-threat type of situation. Nevertheless, I'm sure that some of the things I will say will hurt you. May I say that some of the things I'm going to say are going to hurt me, too, because part of what I want to say today is going to be autobiographical. And I'm going to tell you some of the pain that I have felt. So those are two misgivings that I have, and they're very real, and I hope you will understand that I am a human being struggling to be a Christian in the same way that you're a human being struggling to be a Christian, and we don't always do a very good job of it, do we? Well, let me tell you about St. Sebastian, first of all. Why St. Sebastian? I don't know anything about St. Sebastian, quite frankly, except the pictures that I've seen that come mostly out of the Middle Ages. It may well be that he's a saint debunked now by the current Roman Catholic historians. You know, there was a whole list of saints that came out after Vatican Council in 1963, 1964, saints that were debunked, that were no longer, you know, they were kind of legendary, but there was really no basis for even thinking that they ever existed. St. Christopher is one of them, incidentally. You know, the little dashboard statue that some Roman Catholics have. There apparently never was a St. Christopher. So the Catholics kind of try to soft pedal him. They may well have tried to soft pedal St. Sebastian too, but are any of you familiar with medieval art or earlier? And have you seen St. Sebastian? What's he characterized by? How is he always pictured? What is it?
Tied to a stake and shot with arrows.
Tied to a stake and shot through with arrows. Here is St. Sebastian, a handsome young man, tied with his hands behind him to a stake and arrows piercing him in all his vital parts. It's a gruesome picture, and it was very popular during the Middle Ages for reasons that I suppose belong to the Middle Ages. But in any case, that seems to me an image of a pastor who sometimes feels, you know, pierced with arrows by his people or her people. And we could flip the other side of it, too. I want to do part one and part two both this morning. I was going to do two separate sessions, but oh boy, that'll be too heavy. So I'm going to combine them in one. Not only do pastors feel that way, pierced with arrows by their people, but I'm sure people feel that way, too, pierced with arrows from their pastor. And I'm in a unique position because I'm teaching in seminary these days and I sit in the pew on Sunday morning. And so I feel like St. Sebastian from that side as well. I can share with some lay people, in other words, what it's like to sit in the pew and having this hatred well up against inside you against your pastor. Now, having used that terrible word hate, let me go on to qualification 1, 2, and 3. Both in part one and part two, I've got essentially the same qualifications. And that is, first of all, that pastors do indeed love their people. And when we get down here, I'm going to say that parishioners love their pastors, too. So that's the first qualification I want to make. I think probably there's a love-hate thing going on. Hate is an offensive word, and I chose that offensive word partly to get your attention. And I'm now willing to qualify it and soften it a little bit. Maybe hate is too strong. I'm willing to admit that. But apart from whatever antagonistic feelings or anti-type feelings a lot of parishioners have toward their pastors or pastors have toward their parishioners, at the same time, there's a lot of goodwill, too. And at the same time, to the same people. the pastors that I know are loving people who want to love their parishioners. And their parishioners give them grief in ways that the parishioners themselves may not even be aware. So I want to qualify that and say, pastors do indeed have antagonistic feelings sometimes toward their people, but they also have love toward their people. That's one qualification. Second qualification related to the first is that, as I perceive them, pastors also have a yearning for their people. I, as a pastor myself, in this kind of a situation, both parish pastor and campus pastor, I can hear myself quoting Jesus, you know, looking out over Jerusalem and weeping for those people who are like sheep without a shepherd. And I'm supposed to be their shepherd, and you know, they don't want me. And so there's a certain amount of that in a pastor's psyche. And as we get down to part two, I'll be saying that it works in the other direction as well. This kind of yearning. Boy, these people have all kinds of talent, they've got all kinds of energy, they've got all kinds of opportunity, they've got all kinds of intellect, they've all got all kinds of goodwill, and yet they are like sheep without a shepherd, and how can I help them in this type of a situation? So, that's the second qualification. Then the third qualification is just plain a theological statement, which I think we can make quite, unapologetically out of our scriptural understanding of things, and that is that the church equals Christ. We learned that most forcibly last week, as a matter of fact, at Holden, when we had a marvelous Bible study that Scott led on the conversion of Paul. Remember, he's on the Damascus Road? He's been a persecutor of Christians. And on the Damascus Road, he has this wonderful vision of Christ saying, "Why do you persecute me?" You see the equation that's there? It's Christians that Paul has been persecuting, and Jesus says, "Why do you persecute me?" So I think Christians are within their rights in making a simple equation. Christians equal Christ. Christ equals Christians. Martin Luther says we are to be Christ to one another. A lot of times you hear pastors quoting that, lay people too. We are to be little Christ. But I heard a Luther scholar say, no, there's no diminutive in Luther. He's looked all over and he cannot find that word little. We are to be Christ to each other. I'm to be Christ to you, you're to be Christ to me. We're to be Christ to each other. So having said that, we certainly must respect one another and love one another and hold one another up and comfort one another in our sorrows and so on. Okay, well, what I'm going to lay on you now are the sorrows. Yes?
Clarification. Are you also saying then that Christ equal Christians equal the church?
Sure.
Christians equal the church?
Christians equal the church, right. It is best and at its worst. I mean, we're not always the Christ we should be.
You're saying Christ equals the church.
Right.
And Christians equal the church.
Right.
Christ equals.
Christians are the church, aren't they? I mean, if you're baptized, you're a Christian, and some of us are better at it some days and worse at it other days. You see the point I'm making?
Yeah. I'll talk. Yeah, I hope. We'll
bring it up again. Yeah, I want to talk about a half an hour, and then we'll.
I just wanted to make sure that I was understanding what you're saying.
Yeah. Let me see if I can get through all of this in a half an hour, and then we'll have just open dialogue. Okay. What are some of the reasons why pastors have grief with their parishes? Well, I have three that I put on the board. One I'm calling Constantinian, but it's kind of theological and it's kind of ethical. The second is a sociological observation. The third is a psychological observation. And the first, let's take them one at a time. The first one, which I call Constantinian, relates to the fact that in what year it was, 320, who's a historian? 326, the Emperor Constantine not only became a Christian and made Christianity a respectable thing in the empire, but it was the legal religion of the empire, the Roman Empire. The Emperor Constantine made an incredibly important change in Christians' self-understanding in the world. Up until that time, they were a persecuted minority. Now, all of a sudden, Constantine, the emperor himself, becomes a Christian, and he says it's okay to be a Christian, and furthermore, we're going to make Christianity the culture religion. Now, along with that comes all kinds of problems, and my perception of the world and world history is that we're moving out of the Constantinian era after, 1700 years. And that the world that you were, well, maybe not you so much, but certainly your children and your grandchildren will be facing, is a world much more like those first three centuries of Christian history. Because we won't have all the props, all the cultural props that hold up the Christian church as a cultural institution with lots of power and lots of authority and lots of, opportunity even. And the bottom line in number one here, the Constantinian theological ethical reason why pastors have trouble sometimes with their people is that the very people to whom they are preaching and whom they must convert are the people who are paying their salaries. Now, I use the word convert because I think, again, the world has changed a great bit. My father was a pastor, and I can see him and hear him. He's dead now. I think I'm honoring his spirit and honoring his life and his ministry if I tell you this. He had no problems whatever in seeing himself as a Western American, that is, Western civilization. He came out of a German Lutheran background. He became an American. His family, several generations before, had come to this country and had become citizens. And Dad saw the Christian faith as a missionary faith that was doing great things out there in Africa and India and Asia, bringing sanitation and medical technology and so on. And he saw the Christian faith and the American dream, so to speak, as almost the same. Here was the American dream of the white man's burden and manifest destiny and all that. Here was America as an agent of the gospel doing great things in a world that terribly needed all the great things that technology and medicine and sanitation and so on that had come along with Western civilization, partly as a result of that Constantinian thing. All those great things were part of the gift of Western civilization, and it was almost identical with the gift of the gospel and the gift of grace and the gift of forgiveness. And I can hear my dad's sermons reflecting a lot of that, kind of social gospel type stuff. Let's get in there and help those poor, underdeveloped and deprived nations, and let's be a force for good in the world as American Christians. And I mean, his message was up and onward. It was a very positive, optimistic view of the world. And that lasted till about 1970. That is to say, that mood among Christians. My dad died, I forget when, 10, 15 years ago now. So I'm not sure what he would say if he were sitting here today. But my perception is that there's a 180 degree change in the rest of the world's perception of Americans and Americans' perception of themselves. That is to say, if you were to ask the rest of the world, who are the people who are making the most trouble in the world, the answer would be North American Christians. Not the Soviets, not the Russians, not the Chinese, not the African blacks, not the South Americans, not the Central Americans, not the Iranians. I mean, discounting one or two crazy terrorists. But the people who are building the bombs these days are North American Christians. And the weapons that we are building are supplying both sides in a given conflict. I mean, we have arms that are being used by Iraq against Iran and arms that are being used by Iran against Iraq. It's madness. Who are the people who are using up the Earth's non-renewable resources at an incredible rate of speed? Not the Africans, not the Indians, not the Central Americans, not even the Russians or the Chinese. North American Christians. Who are the people who are depleting the ozone layer? Who are the people who are polluting the environment with all their garbage? What are the statistics about garbage in North America? I mean, all of those are North American Christians, and pastors are now serving in parishes where they must preach to those people and try to convert them from their evil ways. I mean, can we even put it in that, in those terms? This is very offensive. Please forgive me if I'm hurting you. I don't want to hurt you. But I do think this kind of thing ought to be said, and as I say, this is a low threat type situation. You can argue about it and go back home and forget it. But nevertheless, my perception is that a lot of pastors, me included, have the view that it's the people in Western, that is to say North American and European Christian churches, most in need of repentance and most in need of being converted. So the missionary enterprise now is at home, not overseas so much. My goodness, the church is growing in Africa and Indonesia and other such places under terrible circumstances. The Christian church is growing there. And the Christian church in North America is suffering and broken and making problems for the rest of the world. So that is a major source, I think, of difficulty between pastors and their people. Let's move on to point B there, the sociological reason. And again, this I'm sure will offend some people here, and I don't intend to. But it's sociologically demonstrated that the population of people in parishes most resistant to change of any kind are the middle-aged. That is from 35 to 55. The people who are older than 55, they've seen everything and they can, you know, be a little flexible. The people younger than that, they're too inexperienced. They don't know anything, so they don't care what happens. But the people from 35 to 55 are the population of people in most parishes who are the most resistant to any kind of change. Change in the liturgy, the way you worship, change in your service or your posture towards the world, change in trying to reach out to your neighborhood or whatever. It's sociologically demonstrable that the people from age 35 to 55 find their highest value as security. They don't want anything to rock the boat. That includes you, dear friends, many of you. That includes me, quite frankly. Middle-aged, middle Americans do not want things changed. For most part, we're on our way scrambling up the corporate ladder or whatever, trying to get a better job, trying to put two cars in the garage, whatever it might be. And change is threatening. Now, most pastors come into a parish and they say, boy, this is a great place. I'd love to serve all these wonderful people, but I'd like to make a change in the way you worship or in the way you serve the world or in the way you interface with the community or whatever. And pastors look at themselves in that kind of a situation, I think almost any kind of a situation, as agents for change. Let's change these people. And the people with whom they're working don't want to change. You heard about the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain and then the neocortex. Have you gone into any of that in your biology? There's the reptilian brain, the lizard brain, that doesn't want anything to be changed. And as a friend of mine says, if you want to see the reptilian brain in action, just change the liturgy on Sunday morning. That is very threatening to a lot of people. Now, that is bad enough, but as a consequence of this, and a conclusion of this, it's the people between 35 and 55 who have A, all the money in the parish, B, all the energy to get things done. You know, they're the committee members, the church council people, and so on. They have the most competence for the most part. And, the aged, they're ready to kind of hang up their whatever it is they've been working on. They're really willing to give responsibility over to a younger generation. And the little kids and the people under the age of middle age, you know, they're not quite trained or equipped yet to take over those leadership roles. So the leadership roles in most parishes are between 35 and 55, and these are very resistant to change. And that's, as I say, sociologically demonstrable.
They also have all the money.
Pardon?
They They also give all the money.
And they give all the money. Yeah, that's the point I'm making. They give all the money. They give all the time. They have all the energy and all the competence. Not all of it, but I mean much of it, most of it. Okay, that's a problem that pastors have to deal with. Let's go on to C, and C is psychological. And this is going to offend you too, and please forgive me. I don't mean to hurt you. Let me make a parallel here between the world of higher education, which I know best. I've been a parish pastor for 7 years, and a campus pastor for 28 years, and a theological professor now for 1 year. So that's my own personal autobiography. But in the world of higher education, again, the change that I sketched out in this Constantinian worldview and so on, that change has also affected campus, needless to say. Back in 1960, I began my campus ministry, and this was the third year, I guess, after Sputnik, and it was the first year of John Kennedy's presidency, and we were going to put a man on the moon, and we were going to beat the Russians, and we were going to cure cancer, and the whole American mood was onward and upward. I mean, very much like my dad's preaching. Then along comes the civil rights movement, and along comes Vietnam and the peace movement, and along comes women's lib, and along comes gay lib, and all those things just dumped on our society, and we weren't ready for it. And it was a terrible dislocation. And students, the economic situation, you could get a job if you just walked out the door of the university back in 1960. Now in 1989, my goodness, students have to scramble for jobs. And they're so fearful, and they're so stressed, and there's so much pressure on university life. It's not fun anymore to be a student. The caricature of a student at the university where I used to serve until a year ago was somebody with thick glasses and a thick briefcase and no fun. I mean, they have to sign up for time on the computer at 3 o'clock in the morning in order to get their work done. It's not fun to be a student anymore, and it used to be back when I was a student, my goodness. Well, students can make fun. I mean, they find ways. But student life is so pressured and so stressful these days. I got to get a good grade in this exam so that I'll get a good grade in the course, so that I'll graduate with a degree and a vita, a resume that looks pretty decent, so I can get a good job out there in that fierce, fierce competitive world. With the result, as one of my chaplain friends said, pastors are the only people that students can say no to. Now, I want to transfer that to your life as a non-student. Here, your world is similar to that, as I perceive it. I mean, it's a dog-eat-dog world in a way that it wasn't 20 years ago. And I perceive lay people as having such stresses in their life and such pressure, and am I really going to be able to keep my job, or can I get a kind of job that's satisfying? Maybe I have a job, but it's really not a job that's very fulfilling. And all these stresses are so terrible on lay people that when they come in the door of the church, they find, ha-ha, in a society where I'm otherwise powerless, now at last I have some power. In this voluntary agency where I can push somebody around, namely the pastor, and make that pastor jump the way I got to jump in my job. Now, again, that's an offensive way of phrasing it. Please forgive me. But I do think there's some of that mood, I think, on church councils and in church committees, too. Here are these poor, powerless lay people out there in the world Monday through Saturday, coming to church on Sunday morning and finally saying, oh, here's at last a place where I can exercise some initiative and some power and make the pastor's life miserable. Again, that's an overstatement perhaps, but I think it's worth talking about and thinking about. Okay, are we ready to go on now to part two? Now you parishioners get your licks at pastors, because I'm a parishioner too these days now sitting in the pew. And I want to make three qualifications here. Qualification number one is that parishioners also love their pastors. I'm a layman in the pew these days. My pastor is a good friend. I mean, I've known him for 22 years before he came to Waterloo. We were pastors together back in Syracuse, New York. And he's a lovely guy and a good friend, and we go out hiking together, and he and his wife and Kathy and I go out to movies, you know, once a week or a couple times a month anyhow. I mean, we're really good friends. But I say this because I think it's important to know that parishioners love their pastors, and maybe they love them at the same time that they also hate them, or that they also find problems with their pastors. So that's first. And then second, parishioners, I think, and if I'm any example of it, I think I'm reflecting what many of you feel, we yearn for the church to be at its best. I have a brother who is, for all practical purposes, a kind of agnostic, if not an atheist. Strangely, he prays at the table every day at meals. And he even has family worship, but he would not darken the door of the church because he has seen so many idiot pastors doing stupid things. And he's an intelligent person and sensitive, and he has not seen the church at its best. One of the neat things about a place like Holden is you have a little glimpse, in my experience of it anyhow, you have a little glimpse of the church at its best, or better anyhow. Let's not be too self-righteous here. But Holden, it seems to me, as I've seen it, and this is our sixth year now here, we've been here several times in the past 20 years, Holden is a place where you do see great preaching and great music and great fun. And, you know, you do see a picture here of the Christian church with all those wonderful possibilities spread out. And there are a few other places like that, too, that I could mention. Valparaiso Chapel in Valparaiso, Indiana, and St. Peter's in downtown New York City, Manhattan Island. That's another place. I mean, I have these certain little places that are pictures to me of the kingdom of God at its best. And parishioners yearn for that, and so much of it depends on the leadership, the pastoral leadership. And if the pastoral leadership is insensitive or uneducated or ill-informed or just plain stupid, you know, that hurts lay people, and that hurts me as a lay person in the pew. So that's the second qualification. And then the third qualification is the one I added earlier, and that is that the church equals Christ, and that includes pastors. We are to be Christ to each other, and we should take that with great seriousness and love one another and serve one another and hold up one another when we're in pain. There's pain on both sides of the pew, on both sides of the altar or pulpit. Okay, let's quickly tick off the reasons why parishioners have problems with their pastors, and then we'll just open it up for conversation. First, the ethical reasons. Second, theological reasons. Third, what I'm calling aesthetic reasons. You may have a list that you want to add to those. Ethical reasons. I'm not talking now about child abuse or running off with the secretary or the pastor mismanaging the finances. I'm not, you know, those are very, obvious kind of problems, but I'm talking now about other kinds of problems that are not often mentioned. A lot of times, pastors and parishioners have conflict because the pastor is, let's say, pro-choice and I'm pro-life, or the other way around. You could make a whole slew of, you know, there's a great long list, a great long agenda in social issues that cause all kinds of problems between pastors and people. Are you for the Contras or against the Contras? Are you for abortion or against abortion? Are you for homosexual ordination or against homosexual ordination? Are you for the communing of infants or against the communing of infants? I mean, you could have a whole long list here. And if the pastor is on one side and I, as a parishioner, am on the other side of that issue, you know, there's potential for conflict there. That's an ethical reason, and we could add to that list. Theological reasons, they're maybe harder to put your hand on, but I know a lot of parishioners perceive their pastors as theologically badly trained or theologically badly equipped, and preaching heresy, let's say, or preaching that maybe just doesn't reach them or touch them. Maybe it's all very orthodox and proper kind of preaching, but it's not very dynamic. It doesn't really grab you. Maybe it's lovelessness and insensitivity. I know a lot of parishioners see that in their pastor. A pastor is just insensitive to their to the problems that they're facing, including some of the problems I talked about up under part one. Those are difficult problems, and we shouldn't underestimate the force of that. And then finally, what I'm calling aesthetic reasons, the Sunday service is a disaster for one reason or another. And you can put up with that every now and then, and sometimes it's simply an aberration or a mistake. But I've been in churches where Sunday after Sunday, it's just terrible. And I'm not telling tales out of school when I talk about my pastor friend, who is my pastor of my parish, who sometimes gives the impression that he would rather be anywhere else on Sunday morning than up there leading worship for the people. He's a great counselor, and he's a great evangelist, and he's a hard-working committee man. I mean, he's a wonderful pastor. But Sunday morning is not his gift, and he sometimes looks so uncomfortable up there, and so, you know, as if he would rather be almost anywhere else doing almost anything else than leading worship. And yet that's a big part of his calling, and we've talked about this almost in these terms. But that's another reason I think that parishioners have for finding problems and having conflict with their pastors. Let me quit at that and invite your conversation. This is not a session in conflict management. That will come later this week. Kathy, is that scheduled anywhere? Not this week. Anyhow, it may be in other contexts that you find out how to solve all these problems. I don't pretend to solve them here this morning. I simply want to lay them out to you and ask if I've missed anything. There's still more terrible problems that I haven't brought up. And we might also ask about how you solve some of them. Kathy, do you want to say a word about the little steps in conflict management? I think we ought to have structures in our churches at all levels, not just the congregational level, but also at the synodical level, and maybe even the national church level, some kind of structures for dealing with conflict when there's trouble between pastor and people. What are those steps?
Yeah, I think it's important to include that in here also, and there's two basic things to remember. One is that when you want to speak to the pastor, or if you're the pastor and want to speak to the parishioner, you speak from your own resources. You don't say, everybody thinks.
Yeah.
Or some people have been saying, or we believe.
You want to take ownership for your own.
I feel, yeah. I think, I'm concerned, a problem with. You can only speak for yourself. You cannot, phrase, you can't take a bath to your grandmother. Well, I can't speak for anyone else in this room, really, except me, unless you sign a statement for me and say, yeah, I agree with this, and then I have your permission. So to speak for yourself, don't speak globally, everybody, or some people have been saying. That's one of the most
destructive
conflict-raising and destructive means of speaking. It's okay to say I.
Take ownership.
To take ownership. The second is to recognize, you know, one of the greatest gifts of the church is forgiveness, and to work toward finding that with the other person. And you may need to go through some conflict resolution, and that's point one, is identifying what's the conflict. Sometimes what one thinks is the opposite of what somebody else thinks. And we, since we don't have crystal balls to gaze into it and find out what's going on in your head, I have to ask you. And you have to ask me. I have to speak for myself. Second part then is to identify the options that we have. What are the possibilities for solving this? What are ways that we can look at it, deal with it?
Kind of a brainstorming of all the possibilities, including crazy possibilities.
From the ridiculous to the sublime. Sometimes that helps relieve the tension if they are sort of ridiculous. But not give up, throw up your hands and say, well, if you're going to laugh about this and not take it serious, forget it. But, you know, recognize that sometimes we need to relieve the tension. third part then is to evaluate. Don't try to evaluate while you're brainstorming, because then you throw too many ideas out. If you say no too many, the other person say, see, you aren't willing to work at it anyway.
So brainstorming is the wide open. Any crazy possibility should be on the list of solution to the problem. And then, and only then, do you judge and make some selections.
To evaluate. What could I work with? What could I accept?
Both parties in
both
the conflict.
Both parties being free to cross out any of the possibilities. Fourth is to look back over what is there and select the ones or the several that might work for you in solving the, meeting the needs that you both have.
Of both parties.
So it's a win-win situation. Not, well, we're going to do this, and it doesn't matter what you think about it. Then you really
both parties have to sign the contract, so to speak.
There must be something. If you can't find anything you both agree to, come back again at another time and see if you can add some additional points to the list. Often people stop at four, and that's when the problems continue and even grow. Because you say, we went through all this, and nothing's happening. So five, then, is just put number four into action. Okay, we decided to do this and this. What's your job? What's my job? Who's going to do what, when, where, and how? Make a contract. Write it down. Be specific about it. Don't just say, yeah, this will work. And you each go off in your own directions, and you come back and say, well, I'm not exactly sure what I'm supposed to do. But if I'm supposed to do something, they'll tell me. And that may not be what the other
That's the nuts and bolts, in other words. Make sure that everybody knows what responsibilities they have.
Put it into action and identify what your responsibilities are and what the other. And even the time limit.
Uh-huh.
And six is to come back and evaluate what's going on. Is it working?
After a certain length of time to
whatever time you agree to.
Review. Evaluate.
It's an agreed upon time. Let's see how it's working out in a day, a week, a month, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back and say, does it need some fine-tuning, and what can we do?
Yeah. Thank you. Those are the six steps of conflict resolution, and you ought to know about those things. All churches ought to. And there ought to be structures for dealing with conflict that arise out of these or any other issues, too. Okay, what have I sparked among you? Speak out. Go ahead.
I would just like to raise the question. Whether, I don't know if it belongs in our seminaries, but somewhere our pastors need to be taught these techniques.
Yes.
And then also, is there the possibility that they could be instructed to accept the congregation they step into where they are, and then gradually work for change?
Right.
We just had a change of pastors a year ago, and our congregation had learned the liturgies in the LBW and had learned to love them. We have really learned to love them and use
great
them.
Great stuff.
And the choirs used them, and we were very enthusiastic about them, I think. How it happened, I don't know, but we called a pastor who I think eventually is going to work out well, and he's a loving, kind pastor. But he had come from a large congregation that had done its own thing.
Uh-huh.
And he really used the LBW with us because we'd been using it, but he wasn't sure he could use all that stuff, you know. So we didn't pass the piece for a whole year, and it wasn't until the congregation almost demanded it that we got it back.
Wonderful.
And that sort of thing could have been avoided, I think, if he would have come and started where we were,
right,
and then see whether he wants to change.
Mm-hmm. A lot of pastors go in and just upset the apple cart in the first couple months, and that's bad manners.
Well, his emphasis,
among other things,
his emphasis was on doing things simply. So yeah. He simplified the baptism service. He simplified the burial service by shortening and cutting off
stuff that was precious to you. Yeah, yeah.
Fast food liturgy.
Yeah.
What was it? Fast food liturgy.
Very good. Fast food sermons too.
Yeah. Right. No, that often happens, does it not? A pastor comes in and he's got a different perception or she has a different view of things, and there's a lot of conflict there in those first months.
You often thought that pastors don't often understand the lives of the parishioner. And really don't understand what an awful lot of the people in the pew are going through Monday to Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I think, when they begin to make some real demands in terms of committees or whatever, and I'm thinking of the life of single parents, especially, and single parents who are trying to eke out a living come home, feel guilt-ridden because they haven't spent time with their kids, and the last thing they really want to do at night is to come out and go to some kind of a meeting or something like that, and then come to Sunday or through a bulletin or a newsletter or whatever, kind of get guilt-ridden stuff, what's wrong with you, the church should be the center of your life, you know, that kind of stuff. I think it's really demoralizing to people in the pew, and I think sometimes pastors just don't know what that's like.
I agree with you. Go ahead.
Going back to the comment about liturgy, changing it, is it possible that there are some things that a pastor would feel that he or she is commanded by the gospel to do that are so central to that pastor's theology that he or she won't or can't change, and there's no room for compromise? I don't know. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I suppose there might be situations like that. Has anybody got an example? More often, conflict is personality and that kind of thing, and style, rather than real substance. But I can imagine there'd be real substance. Peter, you, anyone else? Go ahead here.
One of the things, one of the areas that I think at least our church certainly has been very remiss in is in seeking to train the ministers as well as eventually at least the laity to go in for interpersonal studies and interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
And that's where we've flubbed the dub plenty on occasions.
Yeah, when I went to seminary, and this is the dark ages now, this is what, 35 years ago? They didn't have anything like clinical pastoral education or supervised pastoral education, which they do have now in most seminaries. Most seminaries now have programs of the kind that you're calling for, where you learn about interpersonal conflict and you learn about dealing with people. When I went to school, it was almost all theoretical and theological, we didn't even have an internship when I went to school. I was the first intern out of Philadelphia Seminary. I went to Philadelphia Seminary. And my roommate and I, we both decided we wanted an internship before we graduated. So the third year, instead of coming back and graduating and finishing out with our class, we each took an internship, he in the Virgin Islands and me in a little rural upstate New York. And that knocked some corners off of me and him. And then we came back, it was purely voluntary on our part. We came back and then finished up with the class behind us. But now internship, I think, is pretty much required across our church anyhow in most seminary education. And internship and clinical pastoral education are both great ways to learn how to deal with people. Go ahead.
I certainly like that idea of let's have the pastors trained in that very well, but let's also have at least some of the lay people highly trained in that.
Right.
I had a bishop tell me one time that when you meet with call committees, they weren't all that interested in knowing about whether the pastor had a master's degree in interpersonal relationships and how good he was and those kinds of things. They just mainly wanted to know, can he preach? That was the first thing. And the main thing they were interested in worried about. So I think it's
we should train lay people too.
More people, and I think mutual ministry committees are fantastic.
Yeah.
Any church that does not have one.
Let's take a survey. Any churches represented here with a mutual ministries committee or something like it? Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, good thing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things, and I don't know if it comes under your Constantinian part of it all, but it seems to me that if you go back in time, that the pastor was the educated person in the community.
Right.
And that now everybody feels like they can kibitz because they also have an education.
Sure.
And they can begin to tell him what he can and can't do and how he does or doesn't spend their time. Mm-hmm.
I'm in a congregation where there's, what, half a dozen, I bet a dozen PhDs.
And it's
more educated than the pastor.
And it seems to me that puts a different pressure in the whole congregation
setting
and how that pastor is going to relate. It didn't take much to be brighter than the regular parishioner
in the
sermon anymore. Yeah. But the fact that you're sitting in a congregation, I'm sure that intimidates the pastor.
Sure. Oh, he's intimidated by me, let me tell you. I make sure he is. It's a good thing we're friends.
Last night, I think it's real telling, I'm here to play God, I'm not really God, and yet I think there's that mindset within many congregations that the pastor still is God and they're not human that they really can work 80 hours a week.
Yeah.
What do they need a day off for? Why shouldn't I be able to call in the middle of the dinner time? And, you know, but I think it's just that some of that thing is just basic consideration. Because we do think our pastors are God.
Here and then here.
Now, you've raised the issue, I think, about pastors, but you haven't talked about the pastor as prophet. And maybe
as a prophet?
As a prophet. And the prophetic role of the
pastor. Oh, boy.
If you're saying, if you are correct in your assessment of where Christianity is moving in North America, and that it's going to become a minority, then we're going to have to begin to teach our pastors what it means to be prophetic in their congregations.
Wow. And people, you see, and Christian people to live a prophetic life.
People do not like prophets.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
You ever see a prophet who lived? I mean, all the prophets I know died.
Yeah.
They got crucified one
at the hands of their own people.
Right.
Yeah. Everybody
dies once. maybe you've heard this said, and I think it's true, that the church, somebody said this 15, 20 years ago, the church, this was a European speaking, the church in North America is still in Palm Sunday, but the church in Western Europe is in Good Friday. And I would guess that Good Friday is ahead for us somewhere too. Down here, and then over here.
One thing that I found really helpful, I'm a pastor and I went through a situation of severe conflict in my last church. But one thing that I recently found very helpful was to use the word conflict management rather than the word or phrase conflict resolution. And that the opinion is that you really don't resolve conflict, you manage it, which is to say that conflict is part of the game.
Part
of human existence.
Exactly.
It's always there. I learned this at an Auburn Institute seminar, 10-day seminar.
Oh, wonderful.
And I have not yet gotten up the courage to tell my people at home that my responsibility is to always stir things up and make sure that the conflict is there. And my wife is looking at me now.
It can hurt though, can't it? And you feel like Saint Sebastian.
Very much. It can hurt very much. But that it is part of reality. And to learn to manage it in ways that are less hurtful and harmful is the name of the game, rather than resolving it, finding solutions to
good
it,
point.
Getting it taken care of and out of the way.
The ministry,
you're in trouble.
Yeah. The ministry has never been an easy profession, and I can see my father, you know, for all his optimism about you know, the future and the American way of life and how much that fit in with the gospel and so on. You know, he had his problems too, and he was a pastor during the Depression where he didn't get paid for a couple of months, and he never in his ministry made more than, he never in his ministry made $10,000 a year. So you know, the ministry has always been a burdened and a difficult job, but my perception is that it's even more difficult today. And may I say, for Christian lay people in the pew, parishioners, to be a Christian has always been a prophetic and a difficult thing, and it's going to be worse. This person here and then up here.
One of the things that, too, seems to be involved with a lot of conflict now is the wider stress.
The what?
I mean, the tendency to distrust power structures.
Yeah.
And coming out of the United Church of Canada, we just went through a whole debate around the whole ordination of homosexuality, of homosexuals and practicing homosexuals, which really tore the structure in many ways.
Uh-huh.
So the conflict is at much larger levels.
Yeah. And that's going to face the rest of us too, I'm sure, that very issue. Up here?
Oh, I just think that the whole setup is dysfunctional.
Oh boy, oh boy. Tell us, if you could wave a magic wand.
Start with one issue, and that is that if you were going to train, you talk about training pastors, if you were going to train them for what the demands of that job is, the demands are, they'd never get out of school. I don't know any other job that has more demands and more expectations, and you're supposed to be good at everything. And then you talk about the financial rewards are not there, and there's no end. And so I think that in and of itself is a dysfunction. We are from a parish that is very upper middle class and highly educated, And I'd like to see the job descriptions of the people that are in our parish and their salaries compared to the job descriptions of our pastor.
Yeah.
I think it's dysfunctional.
You know, most of my career, most of my professional life has been as a campus pastor. And campus pastors are something like missionaries. And I only realized this lately, how protected we were by not having to preach to the people who paid our salary. See, my salary was paid by a national organization that sent me to the campus as a kind of a missionary. Not unlike missionaries sent to Africa or India or whatever. And you know, the fact that I had more freedom. I had more freedom to preach to these people what I thought was a prophetic word.
Yeah.
Because I didn't depend on them for my meal ticket. Now, anybody here from Australia? Lutheran Church in Australia? Because I understand that the Lutheran Church in Australia has a system that may be more functional or more better. Where, what's that?
Equalization.
Equalization of pay from a national source, isn't that right? The churches all contribute to a kind of a national kitty, and then all the pastors are paid the same from a national source of finances. And maybe that would help to take away some of that feeling that, gee, I'm really a court, I got to be a court chaplain to whoever the power is out there in my volunteer parish.
Is that adjusted, though, to cost of living? Say,
yes, and for experience and years in the ministry, and maybe for merit, too, for all I know. I don't know what the system is, but I'd like to learn, and they're proposing this. You know, the ELCA meets in convention, is it next week?
Today.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that's going to come up.
A moment of silence.
What is it?
A moment of silence.
We will all bow our heads. Go ahead.
I just wanted to share one point with the theological reason why some parishioners, I don't know if they hate their...
That's a strong word. We can use a softer word.
If they're afraid of them. As a woman who happens to be an ordained pastor, I found people that disliked me because of my sex.
Just because you're a woman.
And I say, gee, I'm sorry, but I can't do a lot about that.
Yeah.
But I have had the experience where, you know, people will say, you know, I won't take communion from you, or a father came up to me after I baptized his grandson and asked if it took.
Oh, dear.
But, you know, there, I think that is an issue that comes under that. People dislike me because of my sex. They do not because of me, but mm-hmm. because of that. And then another unrelated point is working in a staff ministry where there are two pastors. I found that some parishioners like one pastor and then hate the other one.
Yeah,
and
take sides.
They take sides
yeah.
and pit each other, you know, pit the two pastors against each other. And that is a whole nother dynamic, but I think is you know, where St. Sebastian can be one and then the other can be put on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And I have been both, you know, the one shot with arrows, and I've also been the one put on a pedestal. Mm. And neither one of those
is very satisfactory.
Are helpful at all. And it's I think many lay people know that feeling of, you know, well, I can relate to this pastor but not to this one. And how do lay people and how do pastors help congregations have a healthy relationship with both pastors?
Yeah.
I don't know how to answer that question, but you know, I think that's the helpful.
You talk about feeling prejudiced against because you were simply a woman. My St. Sebastian experience, if I may talk autobiographical for a minute, was in a parish where I felt hated, can I use that word? Distrusted, certainly, because I smiled. I mean, that the smile, as you've been discovering, is just part of me. But the previous pastor, who was there 17 years and very well loved, and a fine pastor too, and another good friend of mine, Lord. But he's very dour. I mean, he's very, oh dear, always frowning and the weight of the world on his shoulders and never a smile. And here Paul Bosch comes bouncing into the scene and, oh, this guy can't possibly be a pastor. He smiles.
You know, or he doesn't care.
What's that?
Or he doesn't care.
Yeah, right. Or he's superficial.
Really,
yeah,
really
yeah. Oh, boy, I fell
carrying
off of
our burden as a parish.
Arrows.
And also being young.
Yeah.
You know, I walk into a room and they say, well, you're not what we expected.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. We wanted somebody with gray hair and a beard.
What's that magic age in between? Because if you're too young and if you're too old.
No free lunch. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if it's any help, but just before our last pastor arrived at our church, we had an interim pastor who happened to be Nelson Price, and he was an excellent, just a wonderful pastor for 5 months. But he gave a sermon to the congregation about 2 weeks before the new pastor was due on the fact that congregations make pastors as much as pastors make congregations, and really encouraging us to recognize this as a cooperative.
Different gifts.
We're ministering together. And we're ministering to one another.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something congregations could help understand.
Yeah, that building on her point right there, a congregation that I was in, you see the slings and arrows go both ways to where the pastor took everything on himself, you know, 80 hours, and he was trying to be all things to all people, and in a way Pastor Bly flogging the congregation towards salvation, and he started resenting the fact that he couldn't do enough for these people. They started resenting the fact that he was leading and
trying to be a Christian for them.
Yeah, and it took him to leave for 6 months and a lot of soul searching.
Burnout.
To get back to the fact that, hey, in the early church and again in Scripture, some. It was a mutual ministering. Some are preachers, some are teachers, some are prophets.
Wouldn't
some
that be great?
And everybody starting to work together to where we finally took the pews out of the rows and the hierarchy up to the pulpit, turned things 90 degrees.
Great.
Made it a stage and
like
not a pulpit. Yeah. And started semi-circularing around and
sense of community.
Yeah, and we ended up putting the pulpit in. You know, they never knew where the pulpit was going to be when they showed up Sunday morning, and it just bumped them out of their rut enough to get people involved. Like, come here, where's it going to be today? And
but it's a much more mutual thing, you're saying.
Yeah, and much more mutually supported than being a hierarchy or the old care pastor type of thing that really was like, it just didn't
work. A lot of pastors feel they should be the Christian for their people, and a lot of people want it that way sometimes. Go ahead, here.
I think often as a layperson that if there would be a great benefit if there were a fuller discussion when a pastor first comes to a congregation over who is to be expected to be responsible for what.
Yeah.
I get a little impatient in a congregation that has a lot of college faculty in it when the pastor is left to spend much of his time on administrative material and on duties that somebody else in that congregation is better trained to do.
Yeah, right.
And he gets into all kinds of hot water because he is doing things that his time shouldn't have been wasted on anything. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if we talked out more fully in a congregation, who is responsible for what in the congregation? And in a way, there'll still be a problem because the parishioners will still blame the pastor if it doesn't get done rightly, I suppose. But at any rate, he might have a chance to spend his time on the things he is trained to do.
Yeah,
and where he can bring the greatest amount of expertise.
Should the pastor be doing the bulletin on Sunday and cranking out the mimeograph machine? Those kinds of questions. Here and then here and then here.
I had three things, two of them are related, kind of touched off. The function of the system, which we talked about just briefly here, and we started talking about equalization of salary. In the area of the church where we serve, we have a number of openings, but they're also what we term first call openings, which means that the congregations can only afford so much. And when they don't get someone to serve as their pastor, they start saying, what's wrong with us?
Yeah.
Where, and also that's the area which maybe our most talented and gifted people should be, ought to be.
Or the inner city, which is so difficult.
That kind of ministry. So equalization of salary, you know, and you know that also
might help.
That's another. It goes both ways, where it takes the pressure off the pastor because you're freer, but also the congregation because you're also freer to keep people and not to. There almost becomes a point where you start to push a pastor out.
Yeah.
Because we're not going to be able to pay the person anymore. Yeah. Huh? Is that true?
Yeah, sure.
And another thing, which isn't related to that at all, is I'm a pastor, but I'm also a person who needs friendships, personal relationships with others. And who will that be for the pastor and family?
Who is the pastor's pastor?
Who is the pastor's pastor? Who are the pastor's friends? You know, that's another issue as a pastor, and there's going to be resentment to a congregation that does not allow a pastor to be that person.
Emil, have we come to an end?
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking about those parishes that are first called parishes, there's also another aspect that enters in there too, and that is that some congregations have had always had pastors right out of seminary almost every time.
Yeah.
And only for about two, three years at the most.
And they
some
mind.
Pastors might want to stay on, but these congregations have gotten in such a rut about this. They cannot take the pastor more than so long. It isn't that they're bad people.
I think we are going to have to quit. One word, can you add it?
Okay. I see the group is breaking up here. For the area of
one more
preaching
minute.
And the Sunday morning service, I found there's a book I found very personally in UCLA, and that's Edward Marquardt. He has written the book, Quest for Better Preaching. He's a parish pastor in Des Moines, Washington. He also runs 5 to 10 workshops a year,
oh boy.
And I attended one of his last spring in the Sacramento County.